Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which believes great beer can be as exciting as great music. Since 1988, Goose Island has been committed to that belief by brewing new styles of beer like 312 Urban Wheat Ale, Sophie Farmhouse Ale, and Bourbon County Stout. Goose Island, to what's next? GooseIsland.com.
This is Sound Opinions, Jim, and later on you and I are going to talk about this new Cannibal Ox record, and I got to say I'm pretty excited that we have a Cannibal Ox record. We had a Bermuda Triangle episode a while back in which we discussed artists who have sort of dropped off the map after making a great album, and Cannibal Ox is one of those groups. I mean, this duo made one of the greatest hip-hop albums of the last 15 years with The Cold Vein, and then basically nothing until now. So we're going to review that new record later in the show.
But first, we have some music news. That's a little bit of the Beatles' 1966 classic, Paperback Writer, written by John Lennon, Greg, on a Gretsch 6120 hollow body electric guitar. We have a couple of stories from the People Will Buy Anything desk. That guitar has recently been sold to the owner of the Indianapolis Colts. I think that's a football team, sports team. Jim Irsay paid $530,000 to a cousin of John Lennon who went over to John's house one day, said, "Hey, I really want to learn how to play guitar." Lennon gave him this guitar, never thinking that eventually it would be worth more than $500,000. This is not the only guitar that's getting big bucks. Rick Nielsen from the Hometown Heroes here in Chicago, or really Rockford, Illinois, Cheap Trick, is selling off some of the apparently 400 guitars in his infamous legendary guitar collection. He is not selling the five-neck checkerboard guitar, but he sold a 1956 Sunburst Gibson Les Paul Jr. for almost $6,000, and he sold a 1959 Gibson ES-330T for more than $7,000. I mean, this is extraordinary, right? He's pruning the collection. He thinks they should go to good homes because you can't play 400 guitars at once, even if you're Rick Nielsen.
Yeah, I've been in the Rick Nielsen basement in Rockford where he has all those guitars. I mean, it is just wall-to-wall six-string. It's incredible. You know, speaking of fanatics, there ain't no fanatic like an Elvis fanatic, and it turns out Jack White is one of those. He bought the 1953 acetate of what is the first Elvis Presley recording, My Happiness Back With That's When Your Heartaches Begin.
Evening shadows make me blue, when each weary day is through, how I long to be with you, my happiness.
He bought it for $300,000. And he's giving it back to us. Well, not giving it. He's going to sell it back to us. He is going to reissue the single on vinyl for this coming Record Store Day.
Well, the reason I call this The People Will Buy Anything, all of those purchases seem pretty valid, okay? But have you followed this story about eBay and the bag of air for sale from a Kanye West concert?
Oh, my God.
Somebody put up a Ziploc bag full of air, allegedly from a Kanye West show, and it got 90 bidders, driving the price up to $60,000 before eBay, the auction site, took it off and said this is a scam.
I don't even know what that means.
No one knows what it means, but it's provocative.
No, it's not. It
gets the people going.
But now a whole lot of people have been imitating that, putting up other air from other concerts, including Garth Brooks, a more Kanye air. There's even somebody on eBay who is pushing a bag of quote-unquote flatulence from Kanye West, available for the buy-it-now price of a mere $5, Greg.
Jim, this show is full of hot air, so why not? You know, why not try to sell that to people, huh?
I mean, maybe we need to do that, yeah. I mean, as rock memorabilia goes, I would kill to own a pair of drumsticks that John Bonham had, for example. But we should toss it out to listeners. What piece of rock memorabilia do you own or do you wish you could own? Are you interested in holding these relics of the Saints? Give us a call at 888-859-1800.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cake, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A built-in remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well-versed in etiquette. Extraordinarily nice. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's Queen performing Killer Queen from their 1974 album Sheer Heart Attack. I mean, that tune never gets old, right? It was the first U.S. hit for the band, but one of many for its label, Elektra Records. And that historic label is celebrating its 65th anniversary this year. And so we go back to our conversation with founder Jack Holzman. We spoke with him in 2011 when he was being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Greg, when Holzman opened Elektra's doors in 1950, it was part of the blossoming of the American independent record movement, with literally hundreds of small labels, each of them dedicated to different genres. Holzman's genre of choice at first was folk, and Elektra became home to Judy Collins and Theodore Bickel, among others. But as the label grew, it really spread out. Blues, rock, funk, pop, world music, all of them were added to the roster. Some of the names? The Stooges, The Doors, Love, Carly Simon, and Harry Chapin.
Over the years, as Elektra has gone through a number of transitions, including joining the major label Warner Music, Jack Holzman experienced every stage of the record business, all the ups and downs. So he's got a lot of wisdom to offer. Here he is in 2011.
Jack, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Jack, you entered the record business before there even was much of a business. How'd you get on the path?
Well, imagine a kid who loves music, who loves everything that has to do with radio and audio electronics, back before there was an audio industry, who is very closed in, who never can imagine himself ever working for anyone else. And suddenly he sees one day a picture of Dr. Peter Goldmark from the CBS labs standing beside a stack, a giant stack, much taller than Dr. Goldmark, of 78 RPM albums. And under his arm, he has a very tiny stack of equivalent LPs. Hmm. Now, that was a big thing going off in my head because it indicated to me that it was possible to start your own record company where you could advance your tastes and work for yourself, and if you were lucky, you might actually make a living doing it. So I decided to start Elektra Records. I had two passions, both of which I was able to make use of as Elektra progressed. First was folk music, and I started with Gene Ritchie and the songs of her Kentucky Mountain Family, followed it up by the songs that Frank Warner had collected from the North Carolina mountains, and continued on this trajectory for years.
Oh, love is teasing and love is pleasing. Love's a pleasure when first it is new. But as love grows older, it still grows colder and fades away like the morning dew. Come, all you fair maids, now take a warning. Don't never heed what a young man say. He is like a star on some foggy morning. When you think he's near, he is far away.
Eventually, we got to a point where Elektra was self-sustaining, but that took about 8 years.
But now this began when you were still at St. John's College and you were running out of your dorm room in 1950, is that right?
I matriculated in 1948, and this was 1950. October 10th is the first entry in the books, which is why we celebrate the electoral year from October 10th of 2010 until October, I guess, October 10th of 2011. No, there's an empty dorm room, and I need a place to work out of because I didn't want to confuse my St. John's studies with whatever else I was doing, which was extracurricular. But St. John's was a very unusual school. It had no textbooks. And I started, made my first album, which happened to be an album of modern leader, which nobody was interested in, and quickly switched to folk music, because with folk music, you could have a very special, a non-duplicatable performance or exposition by an artist that nobody else would be able to copy.
He's the kind of guy puts on a motorcycle jacket and he weighs about 105. He's the kind of surfer, got a ho daddy haircut, and you wonder how he'll ever survive. He's the kind of frogman wearing 20 pounds of counterweights and sinking in the sea like a stone. He's the kind of soldier, got no sense of direction, and they send him in the jungle alone. But when the frost's on the pumpkin and the little girls are jumping, he's a hard-loving son of a gun. He's got a waiting downstairs just to sample his. They call him a spoonful of fun.
You were pretty ambitious on a number of levels, Jack, not only starting your own label in the face of, there were major labels back then that were dominating the industry. And then not only that, there's an artistic side to what you were doing as well. I mean, you love this music and you were recording a lot of it yourself. I mean, there's the story of Jack Holzman on his Vespa motor scooter with a PT6 tape machine strapped across your back, right? Recording these artists in their homes?
Absolutely. I did pack my Vespa with a mic stand, one microphone, a set of Tank headphones that I had bought surplus, and a MagnaCord PT6 recorder. It was a splendid little machine. And I would go to people's homes, and we'd set up blankets against the wall to deaden the sound a bit. The sound that I was looking for was the artist to be in front of the speaker. It was you and the artist in the room together.
I went down to that St. James Infirmary, and I saw some plasma there. I upped and asked the doctor man, now was the donor dark or fair? The doctor laughed a great big laugh, and he puffed it right in my face. He says, a molecule is a molecule, son, and the damn thing has no race. And that was news, yes, that was news. That was very, very, very special news, 'cause ever since that day we've had those free and evil blues.
When I first recorded Josh White, who I thought had always been very, very badly recorded, when we were in the first session and he heard the first playback, he said, you're going to get that on the disc, and I guarantee that we would. But I had every artist that I recorded, I had a sound design in mind for them. Mm-hmm. And these are the things, there were no place to learn this except by doing it and making mistakes and remembering those mistakes and improving what you did in the future.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in the 50s, it wasn't a massive market for folk music necessarily, but the time sort of caught up with it. By the late 50s, certainly by the early 60s, folk was everywhere. So you were the right man with the right label at the right time, I would imagine.
Well, I thought we fit in quite well. By that time, we had a very successful catalog. We had major artists like Ed McCurdy and Josh White and Theo Bikel, who was so important for us. It was very, very tough for us to get radio play because that was the primary, the way you moved folk music and the way was people talking about it with each other and playing records for their friends when they were over to the house. The very, very few radio shows were mostly on public radio stations at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. But over time that changed, and college radio became especially important. And it was nice to be in on something early, and I think that's generally the story of Elektra. I followed my interests when I had those interests. I wasn't waiting for the rest of the world to catch up.
It's a very enlightened attitude. Just talking to you, Jack, about your story, you can sense you're a huge music lover. That's still coming through to this day. It seems like that's where the music industry has lost its way in a lot of ways, that people who don't really love music or don't know much about music are running these big corporations now. And yet you were able to do it back in that era, kind of just on an instinctual basis, not thinking about commerciality necessarily, but about the art itself.
It's certainly true of most independent labels. But even the attitudes of some of the major label groups. I'm still associated with the Warner Music Group because I merged Elektra with Warner and Atlantic Records in 1970 so that we could afford our own domestic distribution and our own overseas distribution. It's a decision I never regretted. But the brilliance of the chairman of Warner Communications was he let us each run our units without bothering us at all. We cooperated where cooperation was required, but we would go after the same artists. The chairman felt, you know, if I've got you and Amit Erdogan going after the same artists, one of you guys are going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot tell you about the other music groups. I observe Universal and Sony and what is left of EMI. I know the Warner Music Group, and I think that attitude is reasonably prevalent within Warner Music Group. Otherwise, I still wouldn't be associated.
Mm-hmm. Now, you made the transition. You said you followed the music with the folk era, and now you're transitioning into the rock era. The Paul Butterfield Band was a big part of that.
Yes, very much so.
Blues with a feeling, that's what I have today. Blues with a feeling, that's what I have today. Takes all night
and day. A racially integrated group based out of Chicago, a white guy at the forefront playing the blues. Not exactly a stock move at that point. I mean, it would certainly become hugely popular within a couple of years, but again, what led you to this group in particular?
I never noticed it was a racially mixed band. I'm a guy who's used to being in New York City and seeing racially mixed jazz groups. It made no impression on me at all. First of all, I didn't find the Butterfield Blues Band. Paul Rothschild, our producer, found it. And he called me when I was in London and said, I found this band and I think we should record him. And I said, yes, go right ahead. I didn't do this by myself. I worked with very good people who were carefully selected and trusted their instincts. Yes, I did sign major groups like Queen and The Doors, which were personal signings. But all of the things that went to make up Elektra over the years were contributions by many other people who saw the way we worked, wanted to see Elektra survive, and helped me.
Continue our conversation with veteran record executive Jack Holtzman after a quick break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later, we review a new album from the alternative hip-hop duo Cannibal Ox.